Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In the summer of 2015, the wave of refugees taking dangerous sea and land crossings to get to Europe exposed one of the worst humanitarian crises in modern history. The war in Syria and Iraq and the worsening situation in Afghanistan has forced hundreds of thousands of people to leave their homes and risk their lives to seek sanctuary in other countries. According to the most recent reports, in 2014, 14 million people were displaced by war. That is the highest number of people displaced in a single year since World War II. And over the past decade, 40,000 people died trying to cross international borders. That is 40,000 human beings. The influx of refugees to Europe and other countries has not resulted in refugee-friendly policies. Instead, what we're seeing is anti-refugee sentiment, the enactment of anti-refugee laws, and the construction of walls and fences. In his new book, Violent Borders, Refugees and the Right to Move, today's guest, Rhys Jones, writes that the European migration crisis demonstrates the structural violence of the global border regime, as the hardening of borders and the closing down of migration routes makes movement extremely dangerous for the majority of the people in the world. Rhys Jones is Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Hawaii and author of several books, including his most recent, Violent Borders, Refugees and the Right to Move. And Rhys Jones joins me in studio. Hi, Rhys. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for writing this book. It is incredibly sad, but so interesting. You bring in so much context that is missing from some of the reports we read, or just those shocking images of people dying in boats because there are so many of them, or people drowning. You traveled around the world to actually meet immigrants. And I think one of the important facts that you bring up in your book is that there are so many people who are escaping, leaving Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, but there are also large numbers of migrants from Ukraine, Eritrea, and West Africa.
Absolutely. Yeah, so in your intro, you said 40,000 people died from 2005 to 2014. The numbers have actually even gone up the last 2 years.
Wow.
So in 2015 and 2016, over 10,000 people have died trying to cross the border. And we still have three more months in 2016. So the numbers are really staggering. But you're right. Particularly in 2016, the people who are dying at borders are typically not from Syria. The main refugee flows through the Mediterranean, where this year about three-quarters of the deaths at borders have happened, have been people coming from sub-Saharan Africa primarily, Eritrea, Nigeria, Ghana, Sudan, going through Libya. Many of them actually had gone to Libya to work in the past 5 or 6 years, but the situation got so bad there that for them, the best option they had was to get onto these extremely dangerous boats and try to make the trip to Europe.
Why did you decide to tackle such a massive issue? Because you traveled to Morocco, you went to the U.S.-Mexico border. I mean, you traveled to the front lines to find out what people are going through. What really inspired this book?
I've been working on borders for about 15 years, and over that period of time, I've seen two broad trends happening. And the first is there's been the construction of a lot more border infrastructure over the past 15 to 20 years. And you can see that in with the U.S., the budget for the Border Patrol in 1990, it was about $300 million. Today, it's about $3.5 billion. In 1990, there were about 3,500 Border Patrol agents. Today, there are over 21,000. But that's probably most evident with the dramatic expansion in the construction of walls. So Donald Trump likes to pretend that there's not any wall on the border and that it's his grand idea to build a wall. But the truth is there's already a 670-mile fence on the U.S.-Mexico border. But that's just one of many that have been built globally. In 1990, there were only about 15 border walls around the world. Today, there are almost 70. So three-quarters of the walls that have been built in the last 25 years during this era that's supposedly globalization. So I wrote a book about that in 2012, about these walls. But as I was writing that book, I noticed this dramatic increase in the number of people dying at borders as well. And so the question that I started with at the beginning of this book is, why are so many people dying today? And with all of these resources going towards borders, you would think that states would be able to provide safe passage to people. But in the book, I argue that it's the exact opposite, that it's as borders are hardened, as there's more infrastructure, more agents, more walls, it makes it much more dangerous for people to cross through these spaces because they're funneled to ever more dangerous routes, and that's directly results in the dramatic increase in deaths.
You also write that over the past 30 years, these borders have been transformed into militarized security spaces. Lots and lots of funding, deployments of guards, as you said, but they're very militarized. And we heard a little bit about this, about the U.S.-Mexico border. We don't hear much about other borders here in the United States. Are they just as militarized in other parts of the world?
Yeah, I think that the U.S.-Mexico border gets the most attention, but that it's one of many that have a similar sort of militarization of the practice of border enforcement. that's evident in the dramatic increase in the walls that have been built. Another border that I've done a lot of research is the India-Bangladesh border, which is one that's on nobody's radar as a place that has a violent border space. But that one actually has the highest number of killings by a border security force of any border in the world. So in the past 15 years, over 1,000 Bangladeshi citizens have been shot and killed by the Indian border security force. And that's very much related to this changed mentality of border control. 30 or 40 years ago, most border patrols were focused on, it's really a policing job. It's about enforcing immigration laws, catching people who violated those laws, and often returning them to where they have come from. Today, the mentality of many border patrols is that they're the front line against terrorism. So although the reality is that most of the people that they're encountering in border spaces are still just regular people looking for work, they treat these people as if they are a immediate threat to the country, and a lot of the violence ensues with that. And that's certainly what's happening at that Bangladesh border. But we also see that at the U.S.-Mexico border. There's an absolute militarization of the mentality of the Border Patrol in the types of weapons that the Border Patrol has and in the way that they treat people that they interact with at the border.
You also raise the issue of globalization and capitalism, and I really appreciated that because that's not really part of the discussion about the refugee crisis right now. You write that we often hear that globalization has made nation states and borders less relevant, but goods and services flow across borders. I mean, you talked about how one example I love is there's a Chinese-owned factory in Jordan where women from Bangladesh travel to make goods for very low wages that are then sent to the United States. I mean, wrap your head around that, right? How do you untangle that? So as you write, these governments are fine with the flow of capital and people moving to work for very cheap wages, but they're not fine when it comes to people, you know, looking for jobs in this case.
Rose, that's absolutely right. There's a paradox of globalization that on the one hand, globalization has produced in some ways the most open world that we've seen in terms of the flow of particular things. So consumer goods move very easily across borders. I mean, if you look at the clothes that we wear in the United States or the phones that we have or pretty much a lot of the food that we eat, it's come from somewhere else. So those things easily cross borders. Money flows across borders very easily. Wealthy people with the right passports cross borders very easily. But on the other hand, over the last 25 to 30 years, borders have been closed down for the movement of labor, which has created these pockets of low-wage labor. In many countries, Bangladesh is a very clear example of that, where corporations can relocate factories there, which is not good for workers in the U.S. and Europe because the high-wage jobs with benefits and protections for workers are lost here, but then those jobs move elsewhere, and the people who are captured there by borders who can't leave their country of birth are forced to work in fairly terrible conditions for very low wages to produce the goods that drive global capitalism.
You write about the free trade zones that were established, these global trade rules established at the WTO. These rules allow corporations to establish factories in the cheapest places possible with minimal tax obligations and reduced environmental and labor regulations, which are critical to the functioning of the capitalist economic system and the maintenance of the wealth. The wealthy as well are able to move freely across the globe in order to manage these trading networks and to spend their money on consumer goods and services through tourism.
Absolutely. So although we think of border of economic capital flowing very easily across borders, it also very much relies on the limits that borders place, because regulations are set by each individual government. And so it allows corporations to play countries off of each other in a race towards the bottom, so that if China has increased wages for a lot of workers, a number of corporations are moving to places like Bangladesh. And then the Bangladeshi government doesn't want to put any sort of regulations on it so that they can attract those jobs. But for workers, it means these terrible conditions. The Rana Plaza disaster, for example, is when over 1,000 people died in the collapse of a building. In the aftermath of that, there was a lot of pressure on Bangladesh to raise wages and to put in place regulations. And they did to some extent, but they didn't want to do it too much because they feared if they did improve conditions too much that corporations would simply go somewhere else.
Mm. Well, and if the TPP is enacted, a lot of jobs that are in China right now will move to Vietnam, where corporations can pay even lower wages.
That's absolutely right. The TPP is another example of this breaking down of boundaries for corporations, for trade between places, but not having the free movement of labor to go along with that, so that labor is contained in particular places while capital can move freely to locate that low-wage labor.
So usually we end the show with solutions, but I want to bring this up in the beginning, because when we're talking about the refugee crisis, because there's anti-refugee sentiment, the militarization of borders, I mean, just horrific. We're seeing horrific deaths around the world. We're not really talking that much about solutions. And you write that the most immediate step that could be taken to address wealth inequality globally, and this is one of the main reasons why so many people are fleeing, is opening borders to allow free movement.
Yeah, absolutely. There are a number of economists who study what the impact of opening up borders and allowing workers to move freely around the world would be. And they generally find they would have a positive impact, both on the countries that people are leaving, but also on the countries that they're coming to. So there have been a number of studies in the U.S. looking at migration over the past 30 or 40 years. And one of those studies found that for each new worker that came to the U.S., they created 1.2 additional jobs in the U.S. So that there's a benefit for the United States for economically, because each of those workers, when they arrive, they are not only working their own job, but they're taking the bus, they are going to the market, they're getting a haircut, so they're contributing to the economy of that place. So there's a clear benefit to allowing more workers to come to the U.S. and to other wealthier countries. And that simultaneously would take the pressure off of a number of countries in poorer parts of the world that have seen really quite dramatic population growth over the last 40 or 50 years. The population of the world in 1960 was about 3 billion people. Today, about 3.5 billion people live in cities in the world. The world's population is 7.5 billion. So it's just been really challenging for a lot of countries to keep up with that population growth. So opening borders would allow movement of people to go to where there are more jobs available, and it would produce economic benefits to people on both ends.
Today, I'm speaking with Rhys Jones, Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Hawaii. We're talking about his new book, Violent Borders, Refugees and the Right to Move. What do you think about Rhys's main argument that the most immediate step that could be taken to address wealth inequality globally is by opening borders to allow free movement? I mean, here in the United States, you know, people are having a hard time finding jobs to begin with. And, you know, one of the main reasons when I read about, say, for example, Trump supporters, racism aside, is that they can't find work, and you know they are struggling to make ends meet. And so if you pose this idea to someone, I would bet that most people would be against it and would say, we can't even find jobs. Can you explain more about how that would work specifically here in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And I think Trump supporters, the economic side of their argument is a valid one, because the middle class, lower middle classes in the United States over the last 40 years in this process of globalization have seen the good jobs that used to exist in manufacturing disappear, and the security that went along with those jobs in terms of having a guaranteed contract, in terms of having health care, in terms of having a pension, those sorts of jobs have gone away for many people. So the idea of free movement across borders is frightening for people who find themselves in that sort of a situation, because clearly so far that hasn't proved beneficial to them. So I can definitely understand that the feeling of insecurity that someone who might vote for Trump would feel, because he has tapped into that that feeling that a lot of people have. What I argue is that by allowing free movement, though, it starts to undermine that system that has created that problem in the first place, because the ways that corporations can make money and the reason that those jobs are flowing out of the United States is that there are these pools of very low-wage labor elsewhere that are contained. So if people there are allowed to move freely, they won't be forced to take jobs for $2 a day, $3 a day in a sweatshop in Bangladesh. Instead, they would have the opportunity to look for opportunities elsewhere.
And you also say that in addition to freedom to move across borders, this means a global minimum wage, global standards for working conditions, global social safety nets for the poor, and global environmental standards. These regulations would prevent corporations from playing different countries against each other to get the lowest wage possible.
Yeah, absolutely. So that would go along with by allowing workers to move freely, but also improving, creating some sort of a baseline around the world for minimum wages, for basic working conditions, whether it's an 8-hour workday, and improvements in the conditions in many factories. If you do all of those things, it wouldn't be so economically advantageous for corporations to move a factory from the U.S. to Vietnam or to Mexico or to Bangladesh. And so instead, more of those factories might stay here where there are higher skilled workers available. But it would also allow workers to move freely in other places to look for better opportunities. So in some ways, it would create a level playing field for workers, whereas today, the situation is very tilted towards capital.
If you'd like to join us with Rhys Jones, author of Violent Borders, Refugees, and the Right to Move, the toll-free number is 86. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately, we can't take any of your phone calls. Radio.org. What questions and comments do you have about the refugee crisis that is happening around the globe, and what are your thoughts on solutions? You can also tweet at Your Call Radio or leave a comment on our website. You know, when the refugee crisis first really exploded and it got a lot of attention, I was thinking a lot about that word refugee and what are the people who are moving and, you know, trying to either find a better life or are moving because of wars or because of foreign policies from other countries that they had nothing to do with. What do they think about being called a refugee? What are your thoughts about the difference between... Well, first off, what are your thoughts on that word refugee and this refugee crisis that we keep hearing about?
Yeah, I'm a little bit uncomfortable with the term refugee because it's a term that's determined by states, right? And it's part of the UN's Convention on Refugees, which originally only applied to people fleeing war in Europe in the aftermath of World War II, but then was expanded to include the whole world in the 1960s. But the convention has a very limited definition of refugee. So it's only someone who's crossed a border, and it's only someone who is fleeing because of political persecution in their home country. And that can be because of their beliefs, but also because of their race, ethnicity, and gender are also listed in that. So the definition is narrow, though. So that wouldn't include someone, for example, that was fleeing for an economic reason. If they have no job and they have no food and there's a famine happening where they they live, that's not political persecution. Instead, that's not considered a refugee in terms of those definitions. Similarly, environmental change, the possibility of climate-induced migration, that also currently is not included in the definition of refugee. So to me, the term refugee is a system that allows countries to exclude a large number of people who are moving for what I would see as legitimate reasons, but they're not given the protections that people who are fleeing political persecution are given.
And so, well, that's a big difference, because how can you prove that? I mean, people who are leaving Syria, for example, can they prove that they are they're escaping political persecution?
So the way that a lot of countries handle that right now is they don't necessarily consider each case individually on its merits. Instead, they create a profile for the country that they're fleeing. And so based on the ways that the government receiving the refugee perceives the conditions in the country where the person is fleeing from, that plays a huge role in whether they will be accepted as a refugee. So today, many people fleeing Syria, I think that in Europe, Syrian refugees have had something like a 97% acceptance rate, because the profile of the country that they're fleeing from is a place where the countries of Europe have recognized that political persecution is happening. And so they're generally accepted, not based on necessarily exactly what they can prove, but on the general conditions in that place. But that creates a lot of problems for someone who's fleeing a country that's not on that list, right? That they may be fleeing because of political persecution in their home country, but if they're fleeing from a country that has good relations with the U.S. or with the European country, and the U.S. doesn't want to offend that country by granting a refugee or asylum claim from someone from that country, they face a much more difficult situation, even if they really are facing persecution in their home.
So under international law, what rights do refugees have?
So they have the right to for their claim to be heard. So once someone makes an asylum claim, and usually the way the U.S. and the EU particularly do it is once you set foot into that country, then you can apply for asylum in that country. So once you set foot in Italy, then you can apply for asylum in Italy. And at that point, they're obligated to provide a short-term visa. Usually it's a three-month visa in Europe that gives you free movement while your case is being adjudicated, to provide basic housing, healthcare, and some educational opportunities for children and that sort of thing while they consider the claim. There's no obligation to accept the claim. Each country sets their own rules on what claims they want to accept and which ones they don't. And if you look at across the European Union, you know, today we often talk about the European Union as if it has this kind of similar policy, but they still – most decisions like that happen on a country-by-country basis in the EU. So some countries have very high acceptance rates of asylum claims. For example, Italy has very high acceptance rates of claims, but other countries have much lower levels. Spain and Portugal, for example, have very low acceptance rates.
We have a couple questions about the law from Rob, and he says, under international law, what obligations do nation states have to refugees?
So there's the Convention on Refugees, which obligates countries to consider the claims of refugees and for asylum claims. There's two different ways that that works, right? One is once you've set foot in the country, then that particular country is obligated to hear your claim. But one of the cases that the EU is making right now is that refugees coming from Syria, for example, who travel all the way to Europe, that the EU doesn't want them to do that. Instead, they want them to stop at a refugee camp, for example, in Jordan or in Lebanon, which have huge refugee camps there. And then the UN administers a camp, sets up a camp, and then the UN will adjudicate the process. And at that point, if they are cleared for resettlement, if they are considered a refugee and they're eligible for resettlement, then the UN tries to locate other countries to take them in, so third-party resettlement. One of the problems right now is the number of people who have been identified as legitimately qualifying for resettlement is much higher than the number of spaces available in countries like the United States and the EU or Japan or Australia to actually take in those refugees. So, for example, the U.S., I believe, is taking in 110,000 refugees this year. It was 75,000 refugees last year, whereas, as you mentioned before, the figure of people who have been identified as refugees is something like 14 million, but the UN says that there's 65 million people displaced by conflict around the world, and that includes people who are still internally displaced within a country. And since they haven't crossed a border, they're not officially a refugee.
And so just to be clear, these obligations are defined by...
By the UN Convention
okay.
on Refugees.
Rob says this is a very complex issue and the fundamentals are not always well defined in media discussions. Thank you, Rob. I hope we tackled all of your questions. I know you sent in a lot there. And if you have any others, please email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are speaking with Rhys Jones about his new book, Violent Borders, Refugees and the Right to Move. Over the past decade, 40,000 people died trying to cross international borders. That's just over the last 10 years, 40,000 people died trying to cross international borders. Rhys lays out a number of solutions. And after the break, we will also talk more about why some refugees are given rights, they're given asylum, and others, for example, West African economic migrants are much less likely to be given asylum, and yet they are also on the move, and we'll talk about what happens when they flee. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately, we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m.
On the next Your Call, we'll revisit our conversation with Kathy O'Neill about her new book, Weapons of Math, that's right, Math Destruction. She details how big data now dictates some of the major decisions of our lives, whether we get a job interview, what kind of college scholarship we're eligible for, even who gets paroled. But O'Neill says that the algorithms that drive these decisions are riddled with errors and bias. Learn more on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, I'm speaking with Rhys Jones, University of Hawaii geography professor, about his new book, Violent Borders, Refugees and the Right to Move. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts on the refugee crisis? And Rhys's, one of his main arguments is that the most immediate step that could be taken to address this crisis and wealth inequality globally is opening borders to allow free movement. And along with that, he's calling for a global minimum wage, global standards for working conditions, global social safety nets for the poor, and global environmental standards. It's going to take a lot of political will, obviously, to get there. But what are your thoughts on those solutions? 866. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately, we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m. Or you can leave a message on our website. We have an email from Mark who says, thank you for arguing for open borders. Henry George, known as the philosopher of San Francisco, pointed out that every mouth arrives with two hands. And then Howard goes on to say, I wish we had political advocates for people, not for capital.
Yes, I agree with that. I think that the idea of open borders, there's increasing interest in it, I think. So, for example, Jean-Claude Juncker, who is the president of the European Union right now, a couple months ago in August, he said that he thinks borders are the worst invention ever. Hmm. So there are some people in positions of power who do advocate for the view that borders should be more open. And apparently in a number of Hillary Clinton's discussions with some of the leaders of global capital, she's also talking about open borders both for people and for movement. So so the idea is floating around out there, but there's also a lot of resistance to it, I think. But a number of surveys about this have suggested that in Europe at least, that the majority of people are in support of accepting refugees, but that there's a smaller but sizable minority that's very vocally against it. And so you see that in the rise of a number of these right-wing anti-migrant parties in the UK, in France, in the Netherlands, that are very vocally talking about not letting anybody come in and about the threats that they feel like it has to the economy and the culture of those places. But I think there's also a much larger, not so vocal majority that are okay with movements, but they're not as focused necessarily on arguing for it.
In your book, you write that in a few weeks over the spring of 2015, David Layton, a professor of political science at Stanford, and Mark Jarre, the former director of the New York City Housing Development Corporation, proposed allowing Syrian refugees to resettle Detroit, a city whose infrastructure and housing was designed for a much larger population than it currently has.
Yeah, I mean, that's just one idea of a way that bringing more people to the U.S. could provide benefits. Detroit, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but I think that in 1950, the population of Detroit was about 1.6 million people. And I believe today it's about 800,000 people in the city of Detroit. So that it's had this dramatic decline, and they've got, I think, 100,000 empty houses in Detroit. And so there's infrastructure there for people to live there. And by bringing more people there, they'll contribute to the economy of that place. So their suggestion was that put those two things together, right? Detroit needs workers. These people need somewhere to live. And they're looking for a safe environment. And it seems like a pretty obvious solution.
What about the desire to go back home? I mean, I keep thinking about the devastating images of Aleppo and a few Syrians who have made it to the United States who have been interviewed have said, ultimately, I want to go home. So do you think by focusing on this, it, I don't know, in some ways lets the government, the Syrian government off the hook, for example, just let these people come? I mean, they want to rebuild their country and they want to go home. They want the violence to end. What about that part of it?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't know. I'm not necessarily an expert on the Syrian conflict itself. So, but I think the larger point that you're making is that most people who move today, there have been estimates that globally, if borders were open, that maybe 500 million people would want to try to move to another place. But those same estimates are that about 3/4 of the people don't want to move permanently. Instead, they want to travel somewhere and work for a while, make some money, and then go back to where they're from. So they're not talking about a permanent migration to live in a new country. Instead, essentially a guest worker type program where they could work for a short term but would probably go back to their home. One of the impacts of the hardening of borders that we've seen over the last 25 years is that that circular migration that used to define a lot of places, for example, the U.S.-Mexico relationship where people from Mexico would come for a few years and work or even just a season and then go back to where they had grown up or where their family was, because of it, the hardening of the border, and because it's so much harder to cross across that border, a lot more people are opting to stay longer and more permanently than they might have wanted to in the past and would do today if they had the option to move back and forth.
We have an email from Mark who says the U.S. population has more than doubled since the Eisenhower administration. Open borders would mask the world population problem with the illusion that the problem is merely local and can be solved by economic migration. The Earth has a carrying capacity that ecologists say was reached long ago. We're on a roller coaster ride to oblivion, fueled by the myth that perpetual growth is not only possible but desirable. Where does this end?
I think that Mark identifies an important issue that that a lot of the we've seen dramatic population growth globally over the last 60 years, and much of that growth has happened in poorer countries. But we shouldn't forget that Europe also went through a period of massive population growth in the 1700s and 1800s that fueled a mass migration around the world as well, and it's in some ways similar demographic and economic changes that drove both of those periods of population growth. But I think that Mark's larger point is also correct, that the world population does need to stabilize and pretty soon because of the environmental impacts that we have on the Earth.
You traveled from Morocco to the U.S.-Mexico border, and you have just a number of just harrowing stories about people who risk their lives to try to get from point A to point B. Which story really stands out for you? Which one do you still think about? I'm sure many, but can you share maybe one or two?
Sure. Yeah, when you go to these border spaces, you can't help but encounter the reality of what the violence of borders means for people's lives. And so when I was in Morocco, it happened multiple times. But the story that I actually start the book with, I was leading a study abroad program actually for students from my university. And we had visited Morocco from Spain, where we were on study abroad. And on the way back, we had a bus that had come from Spain on a ferry, so it had EU license plates. And in our last stop before we went to the port, a dozen, 15 or 20 Moroccan youth kind of surrounded the bus, and it wasn't clear what they were doing at first, but it became clear after a while that they were trying to crawl up inside of the bus, so get into the engine compartment to get into where the tires are of the bus. Our bus driver tried to stop them from doing that, but eventually there was nothing really that could be done. So we let them climb into the bus and then went to the port with, at that point to us, an unknown number of people wedged up inside in the engine around the tires, which was it was really just a harrowing experience for us just to think of the risks that people were willing to take to try to make this trip, and the dangers that they were putting themselves in to cling onto the underside of an engine like that. In the end, it turned out that there were the port was used to this type of thing. It happens every day, and so they did an X-ray of the bus, and they found six bodies in there. But when they searched the interior of the bus, we're not talking about where the seats are, right? We're talking about up inside the engine.
Right.
They only found five of these boys, and so they eventually brought in dogs and found two more boys in there. So there were a total of seven people wedged inside of the bus, just hoping to evade that X-ray and make their way to Europe. And I got the impression that they did this pretty much every day, that they sat there and waited for where these buses stopped and made this effort to climb inside with the hopes that maybe one of them would make it through every few days.
You write that at another port, you spoke with an activist who said that she has gotten to know a different group of boys who also tried to sneak onto vehicles headed for Europe. For months, she saw the same boys every day. They kept on trying to get across because what other options did they have?
Yeah, exactly. I think that a number of people find themselves in that sort of a situation of almost being permanent migrants. So that because of this hardening of borders and the dangers associated with crossing through some means, they continue to try to make it, but they get stuck for years. Another family that I met was a family of Ghanaian migrants that I met also at the edges of Spain and Morocco. And they had left Ghana in 2012 and had been in Morocco for 3 years, living on the streets and trying to find a way to make it across to Spain.
And what ultimately happened with them? It's Isaac and Gifty, right?
Yes. Those are pseudonyms because they're still on the move in those spaces.
And they left for economic reasons. That's what you write. The people leaving countries like Cameroon, Ghana, Nigeria, and Senegal move primarily for economic reasons.
Yeah, exactly. So those countries have had fairly dramatic population growth and also some extreme economic changes as things like structural adjustment policies have been put in place that's transformed rural agriculture, has commodified rural agriculture. A lot of workers who used to be able to find labor there are pushed to cities and live in slums. And when job opportunities don't come up there, many of them will try to move to Europe to try to find a better option for themselves and their families.
And you write that they face a life of scraping by on the margins of society. In the best case scenario, they find work through networks of migrants washing dishes, cleaning buildings late at night. More likely, they'll join the throngs of migrants selling knockoff purses in tourist areas and shopping districts of Barcelona, Paris, or Rome while keeping a wary eye out for the police.
Yeah, absolutely. So what a migrant from Ghana would likely do is if they set foot in the EU, they would apply for asylum. And so then the EU is obligated to, the country receiving them is obligated to consider their application. And they're given housing in 3 months. But they know that very few people from Ghana actually get their requests accepted. And so they'll often leave those holding facilities after a month or two and just opt for a life of being an undocumented person in Europe. With the hopes that then their children and their children's children will have a better future.
Today, I'm speaking with Rhys Jones about his new book, Violent Borders, Refugees and the Right to Move. Rhys is professor of geography at the University of Hawaii, and he is in town talking about this really important issue. He'll be speaking tonight at the Green Arcade Bookstore in San Francisco at 7 o'clock, Pegasus Books in Berkeley tomorrow night at 7:30, and Wednesday at UC Berkeley at 3:30. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. What questions or comments do you have about the ongoing refugee crisis, and what are your thoughts on solutions? The toll-free number is 8. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately, we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m. on our website, or you can tweet at Your Call Radio. Now, we talked about the solution, but talking about the political situation of the day and what's really realistic, what do you think is the responsibility of wealthy countries today to take in refugees? Because many Eastern European countries have refused. Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic have refused. There are about 50,000 stuck in Greece. 213,000 arrived in the first 9 months of 2016, compared with 890,000. I mean, it was massive what we saw last year. For many people, Sweden and Germany are their final destinations. But according to Frontex, 23,000 migrants reached Italy in August. Millions of refugees are in Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan. So, I mean, what's the responsibility of wealthy countries?
Well, to me, there is a clear responsibility that there are people in need who are fleeing violence, and they need the support that wealthier countries can provide for them. So to me, a very quick short-term solution is to increase refugee quotas. And Hillary Clinton is talking about doing that. So she has talked about increasing the quotas to 550,000 refugees. That certainly is an improvement. That would be a positive step. But that still doesn't come anywhere close to addressing the larger situation. I mean, we're talking about 6 million people from Syria have fled. And the other thing that's often lost in this discussion, to change the subject slightly, mm-hmm. is that we often talk about it as a European migration crisis.
Right.
But that's just false. The 10 countries that have the largest refugee populations today that are hosting refugees, none of them are in Europe. The countries with the most refugees are the ones you mentioned just a minute ago. It's Lebanon, Turkey, Jordan, Kenya, Chad. These are the places, Pakistan, that have very large refugee populations. And it's because they're the neighboring countries to where a number of these conflicts are happening. And so most people don't have the time or maybe even the financial ability to buy a plane ticket and fly to somewhere else when they when a war is happening. Instead, they just cross the border to the immediate place to become safe, so that those countries are really bearing the overwhelming burden of this this crisis. Lebanon is the country with the largest burden. I believe that Lebanon has roughly 150 refugees for every 1,000 people in Lebanon. So yeah. It's just an enormous burden for the size of the country. For Europe to have a similar number of refugees in Europe, that would mean them having over 100 million refugees come to Europe.
And what really struck you about what happens when people arrive, for example, in Lebanon? What are the living conditions like? Are there opportunities to find employment? Are there structures in place to provide food and shelter? Because that's kind of also those details are getting lost in some of the coverage.
Yeah, absolutely. So the UN High Commissioner for Refugees is tasked with providing services to people who have fled and are potentially refugee populations. And so in Lebanon and in Turkey, there are UN refugee camps set up for people to go to. In Lebanon particularly, though, it seems that a lot of the people, because there are historical connections between Syria and Lebanon, family connections, cultural connections, a lot of the people there have ended up just kind of blending into the society. Mm-hmm. So going and living with friends, going and living with relatives. Some of them do register with the camps, and the UN has started to figure out some sort of a system to allow people to get services away from the camps themselves, whether it's financial payments or helps finding jobs, things like that. But in terms of employment opportunities, it's most often it's informal, so that people will work with their friends or someone that they know, or find work in a restaurant, or doing day-to-day work, or in construction, so that there's a large refugee population blended into the city of Beirut, for example.
And here in the United States, the U.S. has taken in about 125,000 refugees from Syria. How does the government come up with these numbers? How do they make these decisions?
So the refugee quotas are controlled by the president of the United States. So the president decides how many they want to take in each year. For most of the 2000s, it was about 75,000 people per year, although for a number of those years, we didn't even take in that many. There were some years in the mid-2000s where it was only 30 or 40,000 people actually were brought in. And so that's why Hillary Clinton, so Barack Obama increased it to the 110,000, I believe it was last year, was the quota, although maybe they have exceeded it slightly. And Hillary Clinton is talking about 550 million when she comes in.
What strikes you the most about how the United States screens refugees? Because this is obviously a very hot topic right now. You've got Republican governors who say they don't want refugees. A majority of governors have called for a halt to the problem. Secretary of Homeland Security Jay Johnson was quoted in a CBS piece saying, "Of all the different ways to enter this country as an immigrant, doing so as a refugee is probably the most cumbersome and time-consuming."
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely correct, because people often live in these refugee camps in other places, in Turkey, in Jordan, in Lebanon for years. I think often 2 to 3 years is a common amount of time. And over that period of time, they're heavily vetted. First, they have to demonstrate that they are eligible to be refugees. And then the U.S. has a policy of checking their backgrounds and to try to ensure that they're not allowing people in who might cause some sort of a problem. So out of all of the streams of immigration, I think that Johnson is correct that it's the most heavily monitored.
Rhys Jones is author of Violent Borders, Refugees and the Right to Move. We have a question about jobs here in the United States from Rob. Hi, Rob. Welcome to the show. Do we have Rob? All right. Well, we have a couple of callers. We might be having some phone problems, who say that, again, the argument, we don't need more people coming in taking jobs because it's already hard to find one as currently.
Yeah, I can completely understand that argument, and I think that people are right to feel that it seems like it would be something that could hurt the economy of the U.S. or other countries that might receive people on the move. But another study that some scholars have done, they found that the new immigrant workers typically work in completely different sectors of the economy than local citizen workers. So the top three jobs for poorer citizen workers in the United States are drivers, are cashiers, and are janitors, so working in a formalized cleaning situation. For new immigrants, the most common three jobs are working in farm labor, working as maids, and working as like a cook or a cleaner in a restaurant. And so they're in different sectors of the economy. So they're not necessarily even applying for the same jobs or working in the same labor market. So that's why study after study suggests that when new immigrants arrive, it does not have a discernible impact on wages or employment levels of the native-born population.
There would definitely need to be worker rights laws and enforcement, because it just sounds so ripe for exploitation.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's one of the problems with the system right now, is that having borders so hardened tends to benefit smugglers, for example, tends to benefit human traffickers, because people can't move in a safe way to the country where they want to work, and instead they're forced to use those networks. And then similarly, once workers arrive here, they are less likely to complain about not getting wages or bad working conditions because they don't have an official status. Mm-hmm. And so they worry that if they speak up, then they risk being deported.
Right. And also, it seems that another solution would be to address corruption at the root of the problem in the home country, right? And so people don't have to flee from economic persecution and poverty.
Yeah, I think that that is probably a long-term solution. Yeah. You hear people talking about that. For example, Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, just last week made a trip to a number of countries in Africa trying to figure out ways to do aid programs to improve conditions there. And I think that that is an important step. But more recently, what that's looked like has been the aid agreements that the EU has signed with Turkey and with Morocco, and they just signed one with Afghanistan. And those haven't necessarily been focused on improving the conditions in those countries. Instead, it's been military and security money to prevent people from leaving those countries, right? Huh. So the current form of that has been, I would say, not ideal.
Rhys Jones is professor of geography at the University of Hawaii and author of Violent Borders, Refugees and the Right to Move. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Rhys, thank you for writing this book. Thanks for your reporting, and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.
On the next Your Call, we'll revisit our conversation with Kathy O'Neill about her new book, Weapons of Math, that's right, Math Destruction. She details how big data now dictates some of the major decisions of our lives, whether we get a job interview, what kind of college scholarship we're eligible for, even who gets paroled. But O'Neill says that the algorithms that drive these decisions are riddled with errors and bias. Learn more on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Helena Murphy is our intern and researcher. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.